You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 161. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today, we discuss ethics in remote sensing and other activities with Dylan Davis and Nadu Rasulandrani. Let's get to it. Welcome to episode 161 of the Archaeotech Podcast. Paul, how's it going back in New York?
Yeah, back home after that about month out west. It was a great experience, and it's good to be back home right now. I'm just taking care of things, getting settled back in, and looking forward to what this new chapter of my life is going to be. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing good. Now that you're done with your first CRM project, you're officially a shovel bum because now you're just waiting to go to your next CRM project. So there you
exactly,
go. Congratulations.
Exactly. Looking forward to it too.
Exactly. Yeah, we left Nevada. We're still in the smoke, unfortunately, but we left Nevada and we were in southeastern Washington for a few days. We found out that the Tri-Cities area of Washington, where Kennewick Man was found, that's one of the cities. Mm-hmm. Fans of archaeology might know who Kennewick Man is. Apparently, this is actually an interesting discussion. Because of the Missoula floods that happen pretty much every ice age, it's just these huge ice dams get built up in essentially the Rockies. And as the ice melts, when the ice dam breaks, it flooded the Columbia Plateau with minerals and water and created all these different canals and gorge systems and all kinds of stuff. And there's this one area in the Tri-Cities that apparently has this mineral-rich area called Red Mountain, and it's its own viticultural area. And there's not too many AVAs in the United States, but there's like 40 wineries in this one area, and the Reds are just insane. So that's where we were for the last few days. Now we're up in northeastern Washington. So, all right. Well, let's move on. And Paul, you found an article and contacted the a couple of people that helped write this article. And that's what we're going to talk about, ethics and remote sensing. So let's introduce Dylan Davis and Nadu Rasulandrani. I probably said that wrong, Nadu, even though I practice it. But Rasulandrani. How are you guys doing?
That's great.
Hello.
Yeah, so I ran across on my newsfeed, phys.org, link to an article in Archaeological Perspective by a suite of different people. And Dylan, who'd actually been on this podcast back in episode 86, talking about LIDAR work that he was doing in the Southeast U.S., was the primary author. And so I reached out to Dylan and he agreed to come on. It's a great topic. Actually, I'm glad that, Chris, that you brought up Kennewick Man, because Kennewick Man in the U.S. context is really important because of how it forced us to change our laws and adapt to how we deal with descendant communities in the U.S. It couldn't just be archaeologists deciding that they could use human remains in that case, however they wanted, but had to bring in consultation and coordination with various Native American groups. And that relates then to this article in particular. Let's see, it's the Aerial Panopticon and the Ethics of Archaeological Remote Sensing in Sacred Cultural Spaces. And it tickled my fancy when I saw that, because in most of our recent podcast episodes, we've brought up the issues of ethics in archaeology and ethics in digital archaeology. And there seems to be a growing consensus in our field that archaeologists, researchers have to be thinking ethically about how they're using data, what the relationships are to local indigenous and descendant communities and so on. And that's exactly what this article tackles. So Dylan, how did you come to this topic?
So this really came out of several different things, but among them is my project that I'm focusing on for my dissertation in Madagascar, is where this particular research is focused. And my work, as you know, since I've been on this program before, is a lot of remote sensing focused research. And in Madagascar, I've been doing similar things, not with LIDAR, but with a lot of satellite-based remote sensing. Mm-hmm. And in the course of conducting this work, and then through discussions within the lab that I'm a part of, that Nadu is a member of, and that my advisor leads, we kind of were starting to realize that a lot of this work, we have the capacity to see things in a way that may not even necessarily be welcome by many communities that we are researching. There are places that are taboo, that are, very sacred, that outsiders are not supposed to see. And yet because of the bird's eye view we get with a lot of these technologies. Some of them, especially drones, you can see everything, and that can potentially invade privacy as well as violate the wishes of local communities that we are trying to work with as closely as possible and respect their wishes of them in all the other ways that we do research. But suddenly, looking at their land from thousands of miles away, we can do things without necessarily having to communicate with them at all. And we thought, this is a really big problem that we really need to think more about before we do this kind of work.
Let me mention real quick, Dylan, you mentioned you were on the program before. We should have said that at the top. You were on episode 86, and the episode title is Using Math and Maps to Find Mounds in the Southeastern U.S. So that was a pretty cool episode. We're going to link to that in the show notes for this episode. So if you want to go hear Dylan talk about that, then check it out. But I think a good analogy for people, because I've talked to people about drones, drone work and aerial stuff a lot, right? And they often just don't get some of the privacy concerns. They're like, what are you talking about? This is either prehistoric or it's blah, blah, blah. It's whatever. It's like, yeah, well, somebody's concerned about it. And I always equate it to you get your first drone, even a small one, and you're in your backyard and your backyard is fenced and you know your neighbors, everything's cool. But the minute you lift that drone over the fence and now you're looking at them with a camera, it's weird again. Like now it's just strange. And that's a small example of that, right? But this is on a much larger scale with whole societies and civilizations.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a kind of a silly example of privacy, but how many news reports did you see when people started getting their own personal drones of some neighbor shooting their neighbor's new drone toy out of the sky with a shotgun? It was a regular news article repeated every month or two for about a year, four or five years ago. And yeah, that's personal privacy, which is certainly to be taken care of. But the point of this article, as I understood it, was actually not just personal privacy, which is definitely important, but also respecting cultural norms and bringing in, you know, the point of view of the people that you're actually studying or on whose lands you're working.
Nadeau, go ahead.
Yeah. Actually, talking about privacy, Paul, if you are like in the Western culture, when you talk about like privacy, you talk about like, you know, your compound, your backyard, then your house and your car, something like that. But in another culture like Madagascar, for example, where I come from, in the rural area, people are having a different way of like looking at what you own. It's not just like your house or your backyard and your car, but it's the whole landscape, because everything is communal, you know, and people in a village don't see like what you own there is not mine. Like when you go to till your, you go to a farm, for example, you invite everybody to work on your farm and you don't pay them, but because they are going to invite you also like to work on the farm. So the whole landscape itself is like belonging to the community. So people are not seeing like they own a land, they own a house. They feel like they own, I mean, the land own them. This is a kind of like a difference between how scholars from the West see privacy thing and people like in a country like Madagascar, in rural Madagascar, see like what their privacy is. So this makes this article that we co-write with Dylan like really important, because sometimes people think like it's because you're not like recording people or someone's compound, someone's house, then you think like you're not like jeopardizing or intruding their privacy. But people think like the whole landscape, and you can't really tell which landscape belongs to which village until you ask. So this makes this paper really interesting.
Yeah, and going off of what Nadeau just said, when I was in Madagascar a few years ago conducting field work, I work with a team of local Malagasy archaeologists. All of us in Madagascar within our lab work with the Murrumbe Archaeology Project team. And when we went there, when I went there to do all of my work, what I was testing was actually a remote sensing model that predicts where archaeological sites are located and where people have lived on the landscape over hundreds to thousands of years. And when we were actually going out into the field to survey, there were many instances where, because we were working with the local communities, we were told, like, oh, we can't actually visit that spot. It's sacred. It's off limits. We don't go there, or at least foreigners cannot go there. And so that's also kind of where I started to realize a lot of this stuff, which is extremely important, but you don't necessarily even notice it until you're in communication with local communities and are really introduced to different cultural norms and practices. Because if we weren't in consultation with local communities, we would have been trespassing on these sacred grounds. But because we were in, you know, really close communication, we could realize, okay, maybe the remote sensing found something there. We shouldn't be going anywhere near it, though. And so this does, and that was not even using drones. That was just satellite data. So you can't even necessarily see people, just like Nato was saying. It's not necessarily that people are being invaded on their privacy. It's the landscape as a whole, and how different components of that landscape hold very specific and very intimate meaning.
Well, and this reminds me of something I heard in a GIS class in grad school called the Streisand effect. Barbara Streisand basically has a house, or had a house, in Malibu, California, right on the cliffs there, an iconic house right there on the cliffs. And they were somebody was doing a report on coastal erosion, and they took a whole series of photographs along the area there, like really detailed photographs, and basically published this in a paper on coastal erosion in an attempt to get like a baseline and then, you know, monitor erosion through time. Well, some of her lawyers or somebody found out, and she tried to get it suppressed because she didn't want pictures of her house out there. Well, like, probably 100 people would have read this paper, but since she threw a fit about it, like, millions of people saw it because of her picture, that her house was now published in the whole thing. And that's the Streisand effect, just because, not just because it was published, but because a big deal was made about it. So when you're talking about exposing somebody's cultural assets, be they mountain ranges or even whole landscapes or whatever it is, you know, you might think, well, I'm just, you know, a lowly archaeologist putting a paper out over here. But I mean, to be honest, this could get picked up. This could, you know, something could happen. And all of a sudden they're getting all this undue attention, and they really need to be aware that that's a possibility, you know, from an ethical standpoint.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what I'm struck with actually is what Nadeau was saying about the use of land and the delineation of land. I mean, that's something that we Westerners often think of, you know, this land is, you know, owned by the state. This land is owned by this person. This land is owned by that person.
Yeah.
And so, and that does not map well to many, many different communities around the world. We definitely have that knowledge of that within Europeans coming to what is now the United States and, you know, trading things for land, which is probably a very incomplete understanding on the part of the traders of what they were exchanging. They were thinking they were buying plots of land, and the people with whom they were exchanging were maybe giving certain use to it at certain times, but not actual ownership of it. So varied ways of looking at landscapes, I think, is really important. And tough. I mean, tough without the communication that you're talking about, the collaboration, really, with local indigenous descendant communities.
I think it's very crucial, but it's very important that archaeologists are recognizing those, acknowledging that there is those such kind of thing like going on in another culture, I would say. And if we have a kind of like way of thinking from here, because I think that's what we call like an ethic, a norm that you have to follow, a rule that you have to follow from a certain like a circle where you live, then if you just impose that rule and norms of yours from the West to another culture somewhere where they have also their own rules, they have also their own ethics, then there is a clash there, there is a conflict there. So in order to avoid such kind of conflicts, you need to a kind of like acknowledge that there is also another rule here, and we need a kind of permission. And that permission, you cannot just like get from anywhere, but from the local people themselves.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good spot to take a break because we have a lot more to talk about and we're going to shift gears a little bit on the other side. So we will be back in just a minute.
Hi, welcome back to the Architect Podcast, episode number 161. Today, we're talking to Dylan Davis and Nadeau Rasulandrani. They are two of the authors on a recent article entitled The Aerial Panopticon and the Ethics of Archaeological Remote Sensing in Sacred Cultural Spaces. And Nadeau, right at the end of the last segment, you were talking about permissions and understanding between people. And what this gets to, I think, and it certainly is highlighted in the intro to the article, is this gets to power dynamics, right? This is really the framework that this article is discussing the ethics of remote sensing. Do you or Dylan want to give our listeners a little intro to what you're thinking about this?
So yeah, the framing that we kind of took with this paper was really, as the Panopticon probably hints, as we looked at this from the lens of basically Foucauldian power dynamics, looking at the use of either satellites or aerial photography as a, you know, bird's eye view into the lives of other people, where you can see them and what they're doing, but they can't see you. And sometimes, in some cases, with satellites, for example, they're not even aware that you're watching them. And so this strikes at this panopticon kind of analogy, which it's been made before, but not very consistently in archaeological work. There's been a couple of papers in the past few years that have started to point this out. And really what it kind of gets to, and I think there's actually a figure in the article that in a lot of cases, when we use these technologies, it's, you know, scholars in the Western world or just, you know, academics in general in our ivory towers that are looking at the satellite data or are flying our drone and analyzing our images, but completely separate in many ways from the communities that we're studying. What we were realizing, especially with what we were discussing before, is this can have very bad consequences if you're not really sharing what you're doing and people maybe aren't even aware they're being filmed or recorded or anything until it's too late. So what we kind of argue for in this paper is that these kinds of technologies, especially those where you can see really important things that might be considered sacred or might be private, if that kind of disconnect exists where you're doing this work, it's important to consult with local communities. And so rather than just analyzing this on your own and then going in later and asking for permission to dig or survey, we kind of argue that you should really be analyzing these, you know, with permission of communities and looking at the at these data sets with local communities, not just apart from them until you want to do something. And so all of this kind of gets into how we frame this notion of power dynamics. And by shifting the focus from just us looking at other people, the academic or the archaeologist looking at a landscape, it's the academic and the local community looking at the data together to then study this landscape.
Dylan is right. Actually, this power dynamic is not just like something that happens recently with remote sensing, which is a new technology. I mean, a recent technology that is like applied to a developing world like Madagascar, but it has been like happening with another field. But we, at least like for other fields, like let's say just like archaeology in general, at least we have already like recognized that missing link between the scholars from, especially the scholars from the West to the local community in a developing country. But for this specific topic, the remote sensing in archaeology, the problem is like, because we are like, can always access to those data, whether we have a permission or not, then we tend to just like go on and do our research and analyze whatever. But there are some like very sensitive information that you are like exposing. And I think if you are like really doing science, which is like the search, the search for knowledge, for the betterment of the society, then you have to be careful, because are you like doing a science to just like further your career advancement, or are you doing a science, but at the same time, you're harming the local people unintentionally, maybe. But I wouldn't, and that's the point of the paper. We are not really like blaming the remote sensing archaeologists, but we are just trying to let them know that there is this kind of issue that we may have like, you know, overlooked while we are in the field or while we are doing our research. And we may not really realize the impact of it, but it's a kind of like, if it's not harmful, maybe it's insidious, like in a gradual way, it may become harmful to the local people. So the point here is just like to encourage archaeologists, especially the remote sensing archaeologists, to think about what they're doing. Are they really doing science for, you know, search for knowledge and at the same time for the betterment of the society, or are they causing a harmful something to the society they're studying?
I think that's fascinating that you're using the word of harm here, because I don't think I've heard that in discussions yet about ethics and archaeology. And I think that even the most, the worst researcher out there who's doing something just for his own aggrandizement doesn't really want to harm the community he's studying. Most people have some sort of respect or even love for the communities that they're studying. So framing it as harm avoidance, I think, is really interesting. And Dylan, you just had your hand up. So I hopefully you have some more to offer on that notion.
One of the things that I was going to say, going off of what Nadeau was talking about, was that in a lot of cases, the things that we talk about in this article are things that are very well established in archaeology more generally, you know, community-based approaches, making sure that you're working closely with indigenous groups and descended communities. But the piece that always seems to get left out, or at least isn't really talked about, is when we use digital techniques. So I don't think anybody these days would disagree that you shouldn't go into somebody's backyard or into somebody's homeland and just start digging up random things without talking to people or trespassing on different property. But when you talk about it in terms of remote work, the implication is usually that, oh, there is no harm because you don't touch anything. It's remote. You can't harm anybody or anything from looking at things from afar. But to Nadeau's point, there can be harm that's done, and you know, photographs have done quite a lot of harm in many ways, whether it's, you know, in surveillance, you spy on another country or a group, and that can give you intel that can, you know, potentially help out in a war, but that obviously hurts people on the other side of that. And, you know, in anthropology as well, and archaeology, images have been used in all sorts of ways to paint people as savages versus civilized. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so even though this may not be exactly the same, it has those same potential ramifications, especially when we are doing work that potentially could perhaps implicate people in something that they are not responsible for. If we're using these big data sets to trace deforestation or some kind of major ecological event, and suddenly we've done all this work, we haven't talked to any local communities, and somehow our research ends up pinning the blame on some local group, when in reality that's not the case at all. If we had bothered to ask and get their input before writing these things up, this, I think, is how when you don't converse and the power dynamic is imbalanced, this is how you can cause potential harm using these kinds of technologies, even when the data is available or even if it's not. These can cause long-term effects.
Yeah, I think what Dylan was saying is clear. But what I want to explain is, like, why is it really harmful to the local people? We may think, like, you know, some of us, because we are studying science. I, for myself, because I am indigenous people, but I have already learn science, then I know like some of those things might be like considered in the West, like, oh, those are just like mumbo jumbo thing. But those people, the local people themselves, they believe in those things. And all their life, since they were born until they die, they rely on those sacred places. And they're hiding some of them. And even the neighboring societies sometimes, it's not only the scholars, are not allowed to go to such some places which are considered like taboo, for example. Mm. And for the neighboring communities, they think like, wow, they have the power because they have this sacred place, something like that. And they think like there's something going on there, you know. And for you as a scholar from the West, just exposing that like, hey, there's nothing there but just forest and trees and something like that, you know, it's like destroying the whole essence of the society, like, you know, the values that makes the society like bond together is the one that you are hitting them, and you're telling the other people, like, I mean, the other people around them or the other people from the West or from other area, that actually that area, that so-called sacred land, there's nothing really like a supernatural going on there. It's just a trees and stones and grasses. And just imagine the impact of that to the like the status of the people that group. And so you are jeopardizing, you are a kind of like transgressing even, I would say, the holiness of that land, because you're like exposing them to the world that they're just like believing in a mumbo jumbo, something like that. And I think that's really harmful.
No, that makes a lot of sense. You use the word power again, and to wrap back to the discussion about power and the power dynamic between the researchers and the local communities. One quote that I'm just going to pull out of the article that really jumped out to me was, quote, "To put more bluntly, we're implying that power must be ceded by researchers who have hitherto held it," which I think gets to the crux of it. We had Parker Van Valkenburgh on this podcast a couple of times, and once he was talking about remote sensing data that he was doing in coastal South America. And he referred to it as problematic and that he was having to work with indigenous communities because of the God's eye view, you know, even more so than the bird's eye view, which is what you've used in this article, the God's eye view, which really implies a lot of that power dynamic. You know, a bird doesn't have necessarily a whole lot of power, but by definition, right, a God does. And so, yeah, ceding the power, though, is difficult because, especially as researchers well steeped in a Western tradition, you would think that if you cede that power to somebody else, you end up with worse research. How do you address that kind of a concern?
I mean, at least from my experience, is you always wind up, I think, with better research the more collaborative it is, because when you look at something from only one perspective, you're steeped in that perspective and you kind of get stuck. No one ever has all the answers, and obviously, you know, everyone is trying to become more interdisciplinary and, you know, reaching across the aisle within academia, where, you know, geographers and anthropologists and biologists and computer scientists are all trying to work on these big projects. And that's often the big nature and science papers that everyone talks about. But it goes beyond interdisciplinary in terms of within academia or within research, you know, institutions. It also has to do with integrating local perspectives, indigenous perspectives, because there's information that academics and, you know, Western scientists just don't have. And if you were to ask any of us, we will guess, but we don't know. But if you go and talk to local communities about these things, because it has to do with their homes, they're going to have a lot of these answers that you're looking for. All you really have to do is ask. So I guess going back to the initial question, it would be, I would disagree with the premise that ceding some authority back and having these conversations would dampen the research in any way. I think it only enhances it.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, just to add to Dylan's upset, I think we need to look at what's going on, like in different like glasses, different perspectives, like our perspectives as scholars, but also what is the perspectives of the local people. Because when you are like showing to quote uneducated unquote people a very sophisticated devices and technology like that, they would never understand like what's this, and they would like not only the goat's eyes, but they would not understand like what's going on. But as long as you got the permission from the local authorities, which is the government representatives, then they were just like, okay, if you got that permission for permits from the government, then you can just like host it. But it's always important to explain to them. And I think that's the important part of the paper. Like it's always important to explain to the local people, like what are you going to do? And what kind of device are you going to use? What are those devices are doing? Mm. What those devices can do? And what are you going to use those data from those devices? And what is the benefits of the local people from the results of your research? Mm. I think those are very crucial things to settle before anything can start in the field. We got such kind of like conversation between researchers and local people, you end up like being godified. I don't know if that's a word. Like you become like a god, like, oh, you know, because I was once one of them. Then I know very well, like when we see those people from outside, especially the foreigners, when they come to our place, then we always think like, oh, they're like a godlike people. They're still people, but yeah, they're godlike people. And I think when you start to explain like what you're doing, and there is a kind of misconception. I mean, it's a kind of like a colonial relics that we are still inheriting today, like to show them like how different we are, instead of like showing how similar we are, but we are just from different culture. Yeah, I think that's something that we are missing to explain sometimes in the field. But if you acknowledge that local peoples also have knowledge, it's just different from your knowledge, because what you believe is science, what they believe is whatever they believe in the field. But if you acknowledge like knowledge is knowledge, whether it's from the scientific society or it's from the local society, then you can have a conversation. And they can always understand what's going on if you try to understand, if you try to explain in their language, like this thing I'm doing is like this and like this. So I think the takeaway from this is like we need to like try to converge all those knowledges, and we shouldn't, as a scientist, we shouldn't just like rely on the science part that we are learning from the university. We shouldn't just rely on the knowledge from the science that we learn from the university, but those people also, the indigenous knowledge also is a science. If we can acknowledge that, then we can make more, I mean, we can further knowledge, the knowledge of the world, something.
Yeah, you both make a very compelling case for increasing the amount of knowledge that we bring to our questions, increasing the number of voices to make for better research, to make for more just and equitable research too. But of course, we need to know where the rubber meets the road, how we actually go about doing that in the field. So why don't we take a break right now and we can address, you know, the practical considerations of bringing in local Indigenous communities' voices in collaboration with our research when we come back from the break.
Welcome back to this very interesting discussion on the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 161. This is our final segment. And since it's our final segment, we're going to wrap up this discussion. And something that has really been rattling around in my brain, and Paul kind of alluded to it at the end of the last segment as to where we're going to go, but I'm thinking, if we're talking about huge like landscape studies, right, we're using satellite data, satellite imagery, aerial photographs, even things like that, how do you go actually, I mean, do you guys have any advice for how you actually would go about contacting the sheer numbers of people that you might be talking about? I mean, take out a press release, put something in the newspaper if there is one. I mean, how do you even let people know to satisfy your, I guess, for lack of a better way to say it, your ethical considerations for doing such a large study when so many people could be involved, potentially?
Yeah, this is definitely something that came up not only in our discussions, but even when the paper was being reviewed. Like, how do you consolidate different scales of analysis and different resolutions of data? And ultimately, I think what's important to kind of remember is that this article and what we're advocating for is not ethics is not a one size fits all issue. And there are definitely some contexts where doing this is really not possible, let alone practical. But I think it's important nonetheless to keep these kinds of things in your mind. And ultimately, even the largest of landscape scale studies, you're going to be on the ground to some degree, most likely. And I think it's important that when you are making that transition from looking at things from above to actually, you know, making specific claims or dealing with, you know, ground testing or remote sensing analysis or something like that, at that point, that's where the power structure has to start to shift. And so I think it's not that you necessarily have to contact every single community that's on the entire, you know, landmass of Asia, if that's where your study is taking place. It's that, you know, let's say you are looking at, you know, there are these big, you know, the Amana project, which covers tons of like 20 different countries in the Middle East and Northern Africa. They actually have, there were some recent papers that came out there as well, one of which is actually part of the same special issue that our article is in, talking about some of the same real problems and issues. And a lot of it really also has to do with, you know, expanding the network of people involved in the project in general, crowdsourcing activities, getting local communities involved just in different places with your research that do manage to span continental sizes. But obviously, this is not necessarily something that can be done in every situation. And also, you know, with our study, we were particularly concerned because of the sacred nature of a lot of the places that we were explicitly looking at. And, you know, a lot of the work that we are doing is focused on one major area, which is probably about 800 to 1,000 square kilometers of space. So big, but not continentally sized. So where you have more intimate knowledge of what you're looking at and the people that you're working with, I think it's important to really take these things very seriously. If you're looking at things from a much broader perspective where, you know, the impact is not necessarily at an individual level, I think there's a little bit more leeway, but nonetheless, the same issues have to at least be considered before you start analyzing data, I would say.
Analyzing or collecting?
So I would say both if you are actually collecting the data, but in many instances, one of the potentially great and also terrifying things is that a lot of this data is already there. So, you know, the Landsat program's been circling the globe for 30 or 40 years, maybe more at this point. So there's decades worth of data covering almost every inch of the globe, and that's just one suite of satellites. So, and that brings in a whole new dimension of this as well, because you have, you know, European and American satellites circling the globe, and now you're doing research on countries that had nothing to do with putting those up in the first place, and who maybe they can access the data, but not always.
Right. And some of those earlier data sets are from military applications. So that brings in a whole nother concern.
Yeah.
You know, it's old spy photos.
Yeah.
So practically, if you're working on not a continental scale project, but something more like your project, how do you get in touch with people? Who do you bring in? Who do you ask? Chris alluded to that, you know. Mm-hmm. Do you put out ads in the local paper? Hey, are you interested in this? And then what, in your case, what does that community engagement actually look like on the ground?
Yeah, actually, it's. I think this is something like very familiar to all archaeologists who are working in a developing country. Like, once you get to the country, you need the permission of nationally, then you go to the regional one. Then you need to go to the local authority. But sometimes it depends. And I think that's what Dylan was trying to explain. Like, there's no one size fits all in these things. And we are not advocating for that. Like, this is how we should do it. That's not the point here. The point here is, like, for us, archaeologists, we do have our community because we have the archaeologist community. And we have our own circle, which has its own like ethics to discover past human behaviors. And we are like really sticking into that principles. But we should also know that when we go to another culture, they also have their own ethics because they're also having their own cycles without recognizing that if you are just sticking in your archaeological ethics, then you'd have a problem because you're going to clash, you're going to conflict with another ethics, and you don't want that. So we don't really have advice or suggestion for one size fits all, but I think the main takeaway here is, like, when you go to anywhere in the world, outside of the Western world, then you need to, like, recognize, like, I'm going to weed another culture. And they have their own ethics. Just to recognize that. And when you are there, there is no, like, protocols or, like, procedures to follow. But because countries have different way of, like, doing this kind of thing. But if you are in Madagascar, for example, you have to, like, go to the community leader, and the community leader would, like, organize a meeting. And that's when you explain to everybody, like, this is the purpose of my research, and we are going to use this, and we are going to do that. And if people, like, accept you in that meeting, then you are good to go. So we don't really have, like, a general advice or suggestion, but that's the main thing that we want to advocate. Like, just recognize that there is another culture, you're going to meet somewhere.
And going off of that, like, in terms of the work that's been done in this region in Madagascar where our team works, that is literally the practice that we had, is when we went onto the, you know, into these communities and wanted to assess certain things we had seen perhaps in satellite images, we would meet with every community leader in all of the villages that we happen to be passing through. And so this might be 15, 20 different village presidents that we would go kind of door to door almost. And you'd explain the research. They'd get a sense of what you were trying to do. They could give you some hints on, hey, that's a really interesting project. You might also want to look over here. And so it gets people interested. It gets people involved. And it also makes sure that everyone is aware and consenting to what you are actually trying to do.
So as we're wrapping up this show, guys, I'm curious, in your, obviously, the writing of this paper and discussions with other people, reviewers, things like that, have you heard of any experiences that people had where they did exactly this? They presented what they wanted to do. They said, here's what I want to research and all this stuff. And they, you know, flat out get a no from the cultural group. Cause I would imagine in a number of cases that they appreciate just being consulted on this, because often in the past, archaeologists and other scientific groups have not consulted with local people, right? So I mentioned there's a lot of appreciation there when that does happen, but I would also imagine that there's times when they're like, no, we don't want this out there. We don't want you to do this research. Do you have you got any feedback on that?
That's right. Yeah, I think I've seen a lot of that in the field. And those are not really like the community, local community being reticent or reluctant, but it's because of the previous researchers that were doing bad things to them before. Like, oh, we've seen researchers who came here before you and they came and collect their data. We didn't benefit anything from it. Now you come again, either you pay us or you just go home, because we are just tired of you guys. You're just like from the city, or you're just from everywhere. I don't know where are you from, but you are just coming here to bother us, you see. And I think this is the importance of this paper, like to explain, because it's not just for the researcher who is like going to undertake, who is going to conduct his research, but it's also for the researchers who will come after him. If you are like doing something preposterous to those community, then that will stick to their mind. Like, oh, anytime we are seeing people who come here, either like archaeological study or another study, but it's from from town or from abroad, then it's the same for them. It's just like a loss of time. It's just a waste of time. So I've seen that a lot, Chris, actually. I've seen that a lot.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that actually, that sounds, what you're talking about, Nato, is very familiar from a North American context, where a lot of native groups feel that anthropologists and archaeologists are just there to extract.
Yes.
And that need to change from an extractive model to a collaborative community building, one where it's not to just generate knowledge for somebody to use in some abstract sense, but one that applies both to the local communities and to the researchers.
Yeah.
But there's decades, centuries, in fact, in our context here of bad blood. Of distrust for very good reasons. Mm-hmm. And so getting over that seems like that's the real challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, that's why I like my lab, the OBT lab, where Dylan and I are a member of now, because our lab is like, not only we go to the field and meet those people, but we start from the research design. When we design a research, then we start to communicate with those people, like, hey, we are thinking that we are going to do a research about this. What do you think? Do you think like we should tackle another issue, or do you think like you should add another issue in this kind of research question? Something like that. So our procedure in our research in that lab is like, we start from the beginning until the end. We are trying to be transparent with the local community we are working with. So it's not just like the research design, but even like they're aware of the funding, even like how we get funding. It's not like you just go there and people think like, oh, those are the foreigners who have money. Can you give me some money? Can you buy me this? Can you give me a gift? Something like that. But they know exactly how much we get from the funding and the spending itself. And why we are searching for those, why are we doing those research? Mm-hmm. Even the writing itself, if you look at the paper that Dylan and I were like, and the others were writing, there are many local people that collaborated with us in that name, as the co-authors. So if we are trying to do such kind of thing, I think things will just change. I'm not saying that it's going to change like in a snap of hand like that, but we can change things.
Well, I think that papers like this, discussions like this, podcast episodes where we talk about stuff like this is where that change gets made, right? So we tell our colleagues, we promote these things out, and we just have the conversation. That's what that's what promotes the change. So I want to thank our two guests, Dylan and Nadu, yeah, for coming on. And we have a lot of great links on the show notes for this episode. So go to arcpodnet.com/archaeotech/161 to see the show notes, or in your podcast player, they're probably right there and you can click on it and take you to a link and a paper. So again, Dylan and Nadu, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeotech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.arcpodnet.com/archaeotech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at arcpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.